All right. Good afternoon and a warm welcome, everyone. Although we can't see your faces on the screen, we are so delighted that so many people have joined this online conversation. My name is Rasmus Grue Christensen, and I'm the CEO of Dignity, the Copenhagen-based international human rights organization devoted to the prevention of torture, the rehabilitation of traumatized victims, and the documentation of serious human rights violations. We work in more than 25 countries around the world and also closely with relevant UN and other multilateral bodies. Therefore, I am very happy and grateful to welcome you, Dr. Alice Edwards, to this live conversation on the current state of the global anti-torture struggle and perhaps in particular, how civil society can support the work for a world without torture. Alice, you assumed the role as UN Special Rapporteur on torture around 8-9 months ago. What are your most important new realization and what has perhaps even surprised you from this first period?
Well, first of all, thank you so much, Rasmus and Dignity, for the invitation. I've been involved with and known the work of Dignity for a very, very long time, since my early days working with refugees in Sarajevo. So it's very nice to be here, although with a different hat on. Yes, I took up this position in August of last year. And of course, I've been familiar with the work of the special rapporteurs and have engaged with, including back to Nigel Rodley and Manfred Novak, Juan Mendes, and most recently, Nils Melzer. And of course, it's a very different thing being in the role than engaging with the role as an outside interlocutor. I have to say one of the most, I saw the role as one in which essentially being a global voice against torture and also a role that can represent the interests and goals of victims and survivors within this area. One of the things that has really struck me is how powerful the voice can be. And I think especially in this era of social media, which is very different than perhaps, well, is very different than the role when it first started nearly 40 years ago. And so, you know, one of my most recent tweets, a simple tweet, received 2.3 million views. Now, that was on quite a controversial issue, but I think I in this role have a large capacity to be able to influence, to speak truth to power, and to raise the voices of those who don't otherwise have this platform. So I take that incredibly seriously. Even though I guess one of the maybe it's not a surprise, maybe I knew it already, but of course this is not always welcomed, not either by the United Nations itself or some member states. So there is, you know, it is a fine line to walk, and of course to fulfill the full range of, and scope of the potential of this mandate.
I think, as I mentioned to you just before the interview, you are very, very efficient in your new role. Last week, you sat in Geneva, criticized the Danish government for not criminalizing specifically war crimes, including torture. And on this very day, the Danish government is actually voting in favor of exactly this criminalization, whether that is due to your criticism or long efforts of others is, of course, an open question. But congratulations to all of us for that. But maybe at least for those of us who don't exactly know, I mean, could you say just a little bit, what's the role, what's the everyday tasks of a special rapporteur on torture?
Yes, great. Happy to do that and really thrilled about the impact of my latest report, which was essentially on the duty to investigate crimes of torture. And without a crime, it's very hard to say that you're actually doing that. I think the added impact there was being able to count the number of states that have a crime on torture. And I came up with the figure, and I think it's the minimum figure, because of course I think there's some potential that some of the legislation in certain countries has changed by now. So, and that was 105 countries worldwide. So I think when you realize you're in the minority rather than the majority, there is a swing. So I'm very pleased to hear that. And I hope other countries that aren't in the majority will soon follow suit. And so I guess that's a place to start in terms of the roles and responsibilities of this position. One important role is to, and essentially the historic role of the position, was to study questions of torture. And I think this is where the reports that are presented twice a year, once to the Human Rights Council in Geneva and once to the General Assembly later in the year in New York, I see those reports as providing, contributing to our innovative thinking around issues, to be presenting to states the data and evidence, also, of course, the important role that civil society plays and other actors in also providing information. So it's an intellectual contribution, I would say, in terms of the report writing role. And the second main function, and historically also the case, is taking up allegations of torture submitted to the mandate by individuals or groups of individuals or by organizations or lawyers, etc., representing those individuals. And that, I would say, is part of the vocal contribution. And to be able to intervene on their behalf with governments, submit letters documenting as best as possible the allegations and trying to pursue remedies and redress, and sometimes simply release from prison or quashing of justice mechanisms that have been abused in the process in relation to particular individuals. And the third main function of the position is, so there's the report writing, the taking up the allegation letters, and the other areas are around awareness raising. I've also said I would promote international law through this role. I think in the torture area, there's been a bit of backsliding. There's a bit of kind of complacency around what is a very well-established international legal framework, but some sense that this needs to be kept on the agenda of states. And of course, carrying out country visits, which is more a technical side of the position as I see it, assisting certain countries that will accept my request to visit to try and hear from them about what their good practices are, but also most importantly, to be able to visit unannounced any place where persons are deprived of their liberty, or to speak to any interlocutors whom I may choose, to get a good sense of what's going on in the on the ground, and to work with governments to provide recommendations. The work I've done over the last 20 so years tells me that this shouldn't be a top-down exercise, that and I've called in my first report to the General Assembly, we really need ownership and leadership in this area. And all my human rights work tells me that, you know, there's one thing to criticize or to provide recommendations, but unless the government is actually engaged in that conversation and wants to take that forward, those what you put down on paper or what you say out loud doesn't really resonate. So I think that's one of the things I'd like to take forward in the role.
Well, thank you very much for the update. And I imagine that the question on increasing state complacency is definitely something we can return to. But I like to ask you, because, I mean, you have a rather impressive career as a human rights lawyer, activist, a scholar, even a negotiator. And most recently, you served as head of the this Intergovernmental Convention Against Torture Initiative. Based on your extensive experiences in the field, what are, in your perspective, the most significant challenges? What are the most significant barriers in the global fight to eradicate torture?
Now, this is one of those questions that we would all actually love to have the answer to. I think what we're facing now is both old and new challenges. So we haven't resolved some of the old challenges, for example, unresolved conflicts in which torture and inhuman treatment is perpetrated on a daily basis against civilians and prisoners of war. We have a lack of remedies and reparations for long-standing historic cases of torture, which also can lead into relationships between individuals and divisions within society, and that can lead to torture and inhuman treatment. And then we have perhaps new challenges, and here I name a number. One is shrinking civic space within democratic societies. So it was always kind of an alignment between, you know, torture being more likely to be perpetrated in more authoritarian states. It was a way in which authoritarian governments could had a sense of controlling the population through fear and oppression and subjugation. And now we have, in many countries around the world, shrinking civic space, political divisions that are causing a sense of, you know, frustration with the government. We've also got economic and social challenges, especially in this era of heightened inflation in many countries. And what we find there is then we have things like police overreach and protests and assemblies being controlled and managed in a very heavy-handed way. So that's one of the new challenge. Of course, since 9/11, we've had the revival and extension of torture and inhuman treatment through in the name of counterterrorism. This is also where some of the complacency has stepped in. I think there's been a normalization that in certain circumstances, potentially torture or inhuman treatment could be permitted. And of course, we know as human rights advocates that there's never an acceptable use of torture. It is one of few human rights that is absolutely prohibited in all circumstances, no matter what the justification is. There is never a justification for torture. But the war on terror really kind of started unpacking this. And we still see today the legacy of that that period. And the final thing to say just on kind of where we are at today is that in the past, we understood the prohibition of torture to really be around that context of dictatorships and control of populations, whether that was in Latin America, in Asia, in Africa and other parts of the world. And it was very much limited to kind of controlling political opponents or oppressing the more general population. Now we're talking, the definition of torture has also been applied in many areas that we never conceived of originally, such as psychiatric hospitals and healthcare settings, in homes for orphans and juveniles, persons with disabilities. So vulnerabilities in society is wrapped up with a risk of being subjected to torture. Refugees in the asylum seeker space. We knew in the past that they were always, that there was, they were fleeing torture and inhuman treatment, which was classified as persecution. And now we're seeing the treatment within host countries being equivalent, being aligned with kind of and under the umbrella of torture and inhuman or degrading treatment. There are a wide number of cases. So we're kind of seeing this, we've got old challenges, we've got new ones, and we've got this broadened understanding that the absolute prohibition on torture and inhuman treatment touches almost all aspects of our daily lives. And not to mention, you know, violence against women and the due diligence framework also. So in that context, yes, the challenges are enormous. I am of the view that we more or less know the diagnosis and even sometimes the treatment, but we still are unable to find this cure. And there isn't a cure-all. I think we really need to look at the types of countries we're dealing with, understanding their historical and political context about why torture is allowed to persist. And tackling that on kind of a state by state, but also kind of collections of states. So that was a long answer to a short question, but it is the question, and I'm always also asking NGOs and others, well, you know, you've also been working in the field for a very long time, like, how do we move beyond kind of the continuation of torture as a international violation that is universally condemned but widely practiced?
But this was indeed a long answer, but I think also a really profound one. And I think we could spend several podcasts or webinars on each of them. I like to go back to on the issue of this, what you call the broader understanding of torture or victimization or whatever you call it. I didn't exactly understand. Do you consider that? Is that a change in facts? There are simply more people being victimized in other settings, or is it also, or is it more a change in our understanding of what's going on in the field?
Actually, both. So I think in the more traditional understanding that torture is perpetrated, for example, against political opponents or in prisons, police stations, and so forth, I think we are seeing, and certainly the mandate, as I said to the Human Rights Council last week, has been inundated with requests on a regular basis of persons that feel they have not got a remedy from other avenues. And that's on the one side. And of course, I would always caveat that with, I think there is a big collection of states that are working conscientiously and diligently to try and eradicate torture from their societies, and that there are at times incidents perhaps rather than patterns. But of course, I'm conscious that incidents lead to patterns. So I am aware, and I've warned states of the slippery slope, that we do need to really nip every incident of degrading or inhuman treatment, even if it is every day or considered routine, in the bud, so that we can not get to a stage where this becomes institutionalized and systemic. And then there's the whole pocket of states where there have been long challenges, and those challenges still exist, and there's a denial and obstruction to kind of moving beyond that because torture serves some other purpose. And then on the question about has the definition changed? No, the definition is the same, but like international law more generally, it is evolutionary in how we are looking at these issues. And for me, the essence of the definition of torture is that it's the infliction of severe pain or suffering by a public official and or someone acting in that capacity or in that quasi state capacity. And so when you look at it that way, you end up, and we have seen over time, that actually severe pain and suffering being perpetrated by state officials does occur in all those places I previously listed, in psychiatric institutions, in healthcare settings, in refugee centres and so forth. And I think it's an interpretation of an existing definition rather than a broader definition. We're still using the same definition, but of course that interpretation leads us to be looking at where torture and inhuman treatment may be perpetrated, or where there are risks or fault lines. So we have to be attuned to that.
So I guess that's unconditionally a positive development, that we are now recognizing that torture can take place in so many different settings. But I'd like to ask, within this broader, profound diagnosis, you have, of course, you can't cover the whole thing. Of course, you have defined and set three key priorities for at least your first year as a special rapporteur. I mean, maybe you can elaborate a bit on these three priorities, and why did you choose these within this broader diagnosis that you just presented?
Thanks. Yeah, so I did announce that I would be looking at three main areas, and I should say that they're all underpinned by what I consider the as I said, I think we know what the treatment, we know what the framework looks like. I think those that were involved in the drafting of the UN Convention Against Torture in particular were very astute to knowing that, you know, we're talking about prohibition on torture, like absolutely prohibiting such practice. We're looking at prevention, all of the various ways beyond legislation, but including legislation that lead to preventing torture in the first place, through to a prosecution, so the investigations and prosecutions and accountability piece, through to punishment of the offenders also as a preventive and non-repetition. And then, of course, the important piece that Dignity works on, not only, but is well known for around rehabilitation and remedies for victims and survivors. So within that kind of framework, I'm certain I've highlighted that the legislative framework is one area that I think, although it's not enough, area where we still have gaps. As I said, 105 states have a crime of torture in national law. That leaves 90 other states that have some kind of laws or have none at all and need some work on. I also will be looking at the whole area of representation and community-oriented police and law enforcement. My report to the Human Rights Council next year will focus on this. And this tackles the point that what we know now is that people who are most at risk of torture and inhuman treatment are often marginalized and underrepresented minority groups. And poverty is a thread that runs through this, where people who don't have political power can be manipulated, treated badly, and of course, in many countries, underpinned by corruption. And that perhaps the antidote for that, although I don't think it's the whole answer, of course, is looking at police and law enforcement. And I take that broadly. I also mean immigration and security and military forces. By analogy, where they are not representative of the communities that they work in, plus have no orientation to the community, don't see themselves as part of the community, but above the community. I think this is where there are deep-seated problems. So I'll be submitting a second report on that and trying to get some of the data around what representation and other methods mean for a reduction in chances of torture or ill treatment. And the third piece I met was more on actors around military and security actors. I do want to make sure they are incorporated into the work I do. And this is perhaps related also to the conflict piece. I'm very interested in how torture and inhuman treatment continues to play out in conflict and emergency situations. I haven't identified a report on that yet, but part of that, as well as the law enforcement piece, is also around the trade in torture tools. So I've done a little bit of rejigging of my order of priorities. I did identify that there are still some areas that are unregulated at international law. And one of those is in the trade in police and law enforcement equipment or weapons that are either inherently inflict pain and suffering of a standard that reaches torture, or alternatively are being traded with countries where there's a real risk that they will be put to a nefarious purpose. And I think that's an important development that is going on in the work that we're all doing.
And looking at these three important priorities, how in your view can civil society organizations best contribute both to support your work, but of course also more broadly in the prevention and documentation of torture worldwide?
Yeah, I think I'd preface first by saying, Rasmus, that, you know, these are the subjects of my reports, but of course the broader work of the mandate is to continue to work on issues. Also, I want the mandate to be proactive, so kind of setting the agenda, and reactive. And in that way, I think certainly making submissions from civil society to those reports. But I would also, in the more broader fight against torture, you know, the first thing I wanted to say in this podcast in particular, because of the audience that you have, you know, is keep doing what you're doing. You know, if you're an advocacy organization, the importance of raising voice, keeping things high on either local, national, or international agendas is incredibly important. For NGOs and civil society that are providing rehabilitation services, you know, this is an extremely important role to play for the well-being of individuals, their families, and society at large, but also so that they can potentially play a role as advocates, as witnesses in proceedings, and so forth, to equip them to be the next champions of this cause. For litigation-based NGOs, you know, I think pinpointed and strategic litigation when we don't have good political will is incredibly important. Sometimes the only thing that counts is getting a government to court. It is the hard wedge of the work that we do, and used strategically can be very powerful. And then, of course, there are the NGOs that are capacity-building NGOs and continue to provide that important technical advice and training and so forth. But on that last point, I think we need to, on capacity-building and technical advice, I've thought this for a very long time. I tried to push it through my previous roles I've played. We do a lot of training. You know, we do a lot, all of us have done a lot of training over the years. And I think really trying to integrate that training into the state structures is so important, like through the police academy or through law faculties and medical faculties, et cetera, so that it's not just training for training's sake, but actually people need to get qualified in these, in what you're training on. And it's not just an attendance certificate that is issued at the end of the day, but somehow making this much more embedded, that promotions are reliant on someone knowing how to interview on the Mendez principles, for example, or and those kind of things. So that would be my plea. And then I think on the second part of your question about what you could do, you know, you were more asking me about what NGOs could do better. And I think sometimes understanding better how states actually behave. So there's one thing about assuming how states behave, and there's another understanding how they behave. I'm actually, in my personal capacity, in the process of writing a book about what makes states change their behavior. It's been something that has really interested me for a long time, having worked within NGOs, with Amnesty, having worked in the UN system, having worked with governments through the Convention Against Torture Initiative, and now being in this UN mechanism, but as an independent expert, it's very interesting, kind of the levers with different states, what makes certain states think, what makes them change. And I think kind of sometimes, and maybe here I'm thinking more about some advocacy NGOs, it's the same approach continuously. It's the name and shame approach. And perhaps that is fine for those if it opens up space for others, but noting that that doesn't always work. So kind of strategizing around what's going to work.
What's an example of how civil society can misunderstand or misperceive the ways and methods of governments in this field?
Yeah, good follow-up question. So essentially, there's a whole spectrum of academic research that shows that the name and shame approach does not change state behavior. And yet that is one of the tools that civil society use continue. And it's also one of the tools that I have as special rapporteur. And we can see that it does work from time to time. And sometimes it works very well, and sometimes it may not work initially, but it does have impact later. So I'm not saying it shouldn't be dismissed entirely. But when we start using the same approach for all types of countries, the tool becomes blunt, mm-hmm. or the tool can become blunt. So I think using kind of other tools, quiet diplomacy, or getting others to do the quiet diplomacy while you're doing the louder speaking, those kind of strategizing around what will make countries change. And I think for sometimes the name and shame, and even in my context, you know, using the allegation letters, which are quite hard hitting, right? They become public, there's a public record, the state is required to respond. I think that's got other purposes as well, right? It has the purpose for the victim and the survivor and for national proceedings. It also has perhaps a historic record for later prosecutions, that there'll be a record. I think that's a very valuable role for those allegation letters, even if they don't lead to immediate changes. So I guess, you know, kind of diagnosing, looking deeper into the country, and in that context, relying on local civil society. You know, they know their countries best. They understand the political, social, economic context best. And I think for international NGOs, you know, really working with partners on the ground and speaking to actors beyond the civil society sector, right? So also speaking to business actors, speaking to political actors, so you get a rounded perception rather than a singular. Now, that's a big ask for everybody, no, but including myself.
This is a key question. This is really fascinating stuff. I mean, it makes me think that a number of specialized human rights NGOs, such as also Dignity, we are increasingly engaged in the documentation of torture and other human rights violations with an eye not only to advocacy, name and shame, but also with an eye to the pursuit of criminal proceedings in national, international courts, for instance, for war crimes in Ukraine, human rights violations in Belarus and elsewhere. How do you see the perspectives or the possibilities for this kind of civil society engagement in international accountability efforts?
So I think it's a really important role that civil society can play. And my report I just delivered last week was on the duty to investigate crimes of torture. So it had the legislative framework, but it was really about the duty to investigate. And surprisingly, in the 37 years of the mandate of the special rapporteur, there were only one or two reports that actually made this the real focus. There was a recent report on accountability on the kind of macro level. And then there was a report by Manfred Novak back in the day on looking at all 12 visits that he conducted and kind of going through the legislative frameworks of those countries, but not a broader look. So in terms of these accountability mechanisms, I mean, there is no accountability without justice, that's for sure. I mean, it's hard for societies to move beyond if perpetrators are not held to account. So it has a short and a long-term objective to eradicating torture and ill treatment. What my consultation on this report showed, because the report doesn't really deal with the nuts and bolts of how to carry out these investigations, but in that consultation, there was certainly a warning and a need for clarity between the type of research that NGO actors are doing, whether it's for human rights advocacy or whether it's for collection for criminal prosecutions, and kind of the different standards that may be applied and may be totally acceptable to apply different standards for those two purposes. The standard for criminal investigations is a much higher threshold of evidentiary clarity and procedure and so on and so forth. And there was a warning by one of the participants there who was saying, you know, all of this collection, if it's not well coordinated and the same victims are being interviewed, first of all, you can have overcounting of statistics and therefore a distortion of what's going on the ground. And second, that, as we know, the more times you interview someone, the more likely there are to be discrepancies in this person's story, not because the person is not telling the truth, but because they may have re-remembered something, or they may have forgotten to say something, or now they re-remember the date that was different from the date they said before. And likewise, our memories are very fallible. So I think that for kind of witness testimony, we need to be careful. And also, of course, the piece about re-traumatization and what came out, I hope, in my report on the victim and witness point about the view of psychologists that over time, of course, victims can present a flat effect, is what it's called, in, as I understand, in psychological speak, and therefore are unbelieved. Like, we do have assumptions and about how victims should behave. And my work with refugees over 20 years tells me we should be making no assumptions about how people handle violations against themselves or against family members and how they handle trauma. I think it's very personalized. And also, we also make assumptions about men and women. And that was definitely one of the first things I learned as a young legal advisor, that the men wanted to continue to go back to the counseling we provided and the women didn't. And yet all the counseling was geared towards women in the context of the Balkans back in the day. So it was a very, so yes, it's a super important role to play. But knowing the purpose for why you're carrying out the information gathering, to put it in broad term, and who you're getting the information from and what it's going to be used for in the future would be useful.
Well, thank you very much for this. I think another very important, profound issue, and I think the whole issue around how we do we ensure a victim-centered approach to documentation of human rights violation, I mean, is just such a pertinent issue that we could also deal with in a whole other podcast. Now, you mentioned yourself, and we have approximately 7-8 minutes to go, but now you mentioned gender yourself, and of course, I'd like to mention, I mean, of course, quite obviously, your appointment as special rapporteur is of course historic, because you're the first woman to occupy the mandate, but also because you are an outspoken feminist that have helped pave the way for rather significant changes in human rights law by demonstrating that rape and sexual violence are in fact forms of torture and ill treatment. So building from this, I think it's fair to say, groundbreaking work. I mean, how do you see the current spaces, possibilities for more feminist interpretations of the commission, the prevention of torture?
I mean, one of the reasons why that work is considered groundbreaking is, interestingly, because still under international law, there's no absolute prohibition on violence against women and girls. There's actually no prohibition on violence per se. We need to frame it within the prohibition on torture or potentially security and liberty of person or potentially the right to life or enforced disappearances. So it kind of became, and it still is, a very important tool for dealing with issues around violence against women and girls, which is prolific across the world, no matter what society you come from. Women and girls are at extreme risk of violence, and we're not talking stranger violence, we're talking from intimate, you know, family members who should be the people they can love and trust in safety. And that, I think, is something that is worthwhile pursuing as a thread throughout the work I will be doing. I think there's some backsliding around these issues. There are some people questioning the due diligence framework. This is idea for those of your listeners, because we generally understand torture to be perpetrated by a public official or other person acting in a quasi-official capacity. And so there've always been these questions around, well, you know, violence against women and intimate partner violence, and the way in which public authorities have been brought into that is to establish accountability on the basis of either a failure to respond or a failure to take the necessary steps to respond. It's still a state responsibility, even though that violence may be occurring in the private realm. And we do, there are pockets of jurists and others who don't share those views, that think that perhaps this is a too expanded view of the torture definition. But we started this conversation, Rasmus, by saying actually it's not an expanded definition of the definition is the same. What we are doing is interpreting that definition to apply to circumstances that perhaps we didn't necessarily conceive of back in the day. But one thing to point out here is the definition of torture has one of the purposes of it. It's not just to force a confession or to obtain information through interrogation. It also has discrimination of any kind as one of the key purposes within the definition. And I think that is a very important entry point. And if we forget that, we kind of have narrowed beyond what the drafters were considering at the time and where society is right now. Let's be anybody that says to Afghan women in this day and age and all of the horrors that they are facing, including total exclusion from society, that this is not something we should be concerned of under this absolute prohibition of torture and inhuman treatment, because that's the prohibition. But what we're trying to advance is a life of dignity, a life to live the life that you want to lead in freedom and security. That's kind of the flip side for me of when we no longer have torture in society, what does the other side look like? It looks like we can all be who we want to be in a safe and rights-based and rule-based system.
Well, thank you very much for that. This is also really some heated intellectual debates that we are having inside Dignity as well. This is really, really important, crucial discussions to be further discussed in the coming months and years. Now I can see that we only have a minute or two to go, so maybe I should ask you as a final question. I mean, these are, of course, still relatively early days for you as a special rapporteur, but what would you like to be remembered for once your mandate expires? What should be your accomplishments or your impact on the field when you are handing over the torch?
That's a really hard question, but I actually think it's a question for others. It will be for others to judge at the end of the day. But from my side, I hope no matter the type of interlocutor that I'll be considered an honest and fair special rapporteur on torture, and hopefully have brought some new ways of thinking about things and some impetus, and also lent my voice to the excellent work of others. So thank you very much, Rasmus.
Well, thank you so much, Alice, for joining and for enlightening us at this live conversation. Let us meet again in a year's time and take a new stock on the global fight against torture. And thank you very much to all of you who joined in the online audience. If you will stay updated on more talks and our work, our research in Dignity, please sign up to our newsletter. You can find the link in the chat. And then I think I can just say have a nice afternoon or morning or evening wherever you are. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.